Sleep while we were praying. Okay. A psalm of David. Ascribe to Yahweh, O sons of the mighty. Ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. Ascribe to Yahweh the glory of his name. Worship Yahweh in the splendor of holiness. The voice of Yahweh is upon the waters. The glory of God thunders. Yahweh is over many waters. The voice of Yahweh is powerful. The voice of Yahweh is full of splendor. The voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars. Indeed, Yahweh breaks into pieces the cedars of Lebanon. He makes Lebanon skip like a calf, and Syrian like a young wild ox. The voice of Yahweh hews out flames of fire. The voice of Yahweh causes the wilderness to tremble. Yahweh causes the wilderness of Kadesh to tremble. The voice of Yahweh makes the deer to calve and strips the forest bare. And in his temple, everything says glory. Yahweh sat enthroned over the flood. Indeed, Yahweh sits as king forever. Yahweh will give strength to his people. Yahweh will bless his people with peace. Sometimes, as New Testament Christians, we get this misconception in our mind about God kind of being like a nice old grandpa that, you know, winks at you quite a bit, because we've been brought up on stories of God being our father and us being able to say to him, Abba, or Daddy. And this conception of God is absolutely true and accurate. And sometimes, though, we can lose track of some of the other aspects that our God has. We lose track of God's transcendence because we continue to learn about his immanence, his closeness to us. Sometimes we lose track of how he is entirely other, how he is beyond our imagination in matters of splendor and power and, you know, just straight up awesomeness and, dare I say, in terrifying, in an aspect of being terrifying. You know, his fearsomeness, his otherness. And Psalm 29 is basically a call to worship and then a final, bout of praise with a couple of verses with a big old theophany right in the middle. And I think it's interesting because most of the time I have to say, as modern Americans, we have a hard time understanding, some of the things that are talked about. But frankly, as people in North America, we would actually have a better idea about some of this stuff than some of the people in the ancient Near East, because they rarely get thunderstorms like this. This is a theophany that is centered around evidently a once-in-a-lifetime thunderstorm that is breaking trees into pieces. But here in the United States, we get bangers like that fairly often. You have probably been outside, I mean, unless you just run and hide yourself during a really, really tough thunderstorm, you've probably seen something along these lines. I remember one time, it was a really long time ago, I was outside in a thunderstorm and the rain was coming at me straight. It wasn't going down. It was just flying straight at me. Right? I mean, there was lightning everywhere. It was incredibly loud, super close. You know, I got up one day, you know, much, much later, I had a tree down on both sides of my house. I had one down on one side of my house, and half of another tree was down on the other side of my house. Did not touch my house. Got within like that close on one of the sides. Fell just perfectly to not hit anything. But we've seen bangers like this. And one of the difficulties trying to teach a psalm that's, you know, frankly, mostly just a really, really vivid theophany and picture of God's majesty is that it really defies being dissected the way we like to do, where we're like, no, because, you know, I can talk about different things, but because of the chiastic structure, you know, it talks about God being over the flood at the beginning and then towards the end, right? And so it's kind of, sometimes it's a little difficult to say exactly where you want to put this thing about it, but it evokes a number of really important and valuable things to know and to meditate about God as it brings it out. So realize that I place things in certain places, but really, these things are webs. They're interconnected. I'll be talking about one thing, and it'll talk about something else that I'm going to talk about later, because this stuff is all just like mixed together, right? And so, just fair warning, we're going to talk about a lot of things that this poem evokes, and it talks to us about in the nature of God. Now it says, "Ascribe to Yahweh, O sons of the mighty." And right off the bat, we have an interesting interpretive challenge, because some people feel like this is talking about angels. And yet the exact same word in Exodus chapter 15, verse 11, is going to be, here God is being praised after defeating Pharaoh and throwing his army into the sea. They say, "Who is like you among the gods, O Yahweh? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, fearsome in praises, working wonders? Who is like you among the gods?" Little g, right? And here we have a world that David is writing to that is still believes that there are other gods. The children of Israel are not properly monotheistic yet. They don't get broken of their little, worshiping other gods habits until the exile. And so there's this, and the thing is that really it kind of comes to the same thing, because we learn in the New Testament that false gods are really just demons, right, that are sporting around the place trying to compete with God and giving out counterfeits, right? So it really comes to the same thing. And so we have here a call to worship Yahweh in his splendor that is directed to other divine beings, or like angelic beings, people's conceptions of gods. Everybody needs to get down on one knee before Yahweh, even the other gods, right? Now, is this really a call to worship to other gods or to angels? No, David is writing this to the children of Israel, right? This is poetically being cast as a call to worship for divine beings. Even divine beings need to ascribe to him his glory and his power because of his supremacy over everything else. There's him, and then there's everything else when it comes to glory and majesty and power, right? And so it's being poetically cast as, "O sons of the mighty, bend the knee. Ascribe to Yahweh, O sons of the mighty. Ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. Ascribe to Yahweh the glory of his name. Worship Yahweh in splendor of holiness." This term, splendor of holiness, is sometimes translated as royal robes, or as the attire that you wear. But that's like derivative of the idea that this is God, splendidly arrayed in his royal robes. And it's giving you a picture of him as king on his throne over all the universe. And all others are supposed to ascribe to him glory and strength. Let's pop on over to Exodus chapter 19, to something that I'm sure you guys are all very familiar with, but I think that it starts us off on the right foot as we are looking at the awesome presence of God. The children of Israel have been rescued. 10 plagues have taken place. The sea has split open. And they have crossed, and then the sea has devoured the army of the most powerful nation they have ever encountered. And now God has led them in his glory to Sinai. And they get there, and immediately things get a little frightening for the children of Israel. And what's so frightening? God is. God's so frightening. Because they are approaching God himself in all his awesomeness. It says, so it happened. This is Exodus 19, starting in verse 16. "So it happened on the third day that when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled." Okay, see how I tell you that everything's like, all mixed together here? Here we're talking about the sound of thunder, lightning flashes, which is all throughout that theophany that we're about to talk about, right? This awesome majesty of God that is described in this way. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because Yahweh descended upon it in fire. It's easy enough to just like let this like bounce around in your head, but try to stick yourself in the feet of these people coming up on a mountain covered in smoke, thunder, lightning flashes, fire. I don't want to go up there. Oh my goodness, I don't want to go anywhere near that mountain. That is a scary mountain. And the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. And Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. And Yahweh, this is all about the voice of the Lord, guys, so just like you keep that in mind while we're reading, right? And Yahweh came down to Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and Yahweh called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Then Yahweh spoke to Moses, "Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to Yahweh to see, and many of them perish." Now today, because of the blood of Christ, we may enter the presence of God anytime we like. He's made that way for us. But the presence of God is a privilege that has not always been enjoyed. The presence of God can be lethal to created beings like us. "Also, let the priests who come near to Yahweh set themselves apart as holy, lest Yahweh break out against them." And Moses said to Yahweh, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, 'Set bounds about the mountain and set it apart as holy.'" And Yahweh said to him, "Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to Yahweh, lest he break out against them." So Moses went down to the people and told them. And then he gives them the Ten Commandments, right? And you guys are familiar with the Ten Commandments. After he's done finishing up with the coveting in verse 17, he says, "And all the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And the people perceived it, and they shook and stood at a distance. And they said to Moses, 'Speak to us yourself and we will listen, but let not God speak to us, lest we die.'" The voice of the Lord can be intensely frightening. He is awesome and supernatural, right? That's what it's talking about with the terrifying, transcendent nature of God. Human beings understand instinctively that the presence of the divine is dangerous to us because we are so much less than he is. The people fear to approach the presence of God. Thunder, lightning, darkness, real danger. And in the middle of it, you know he said, "You shall have no other gods in my face." He demands exclusivity. "I am the one true God." And they're going to say, "Oh yeah, we totally agree to that." But you know, the record shows that they did not, for the most part, totally agree to that. They're going to struggle with that quite a bit. And we too must ascribe to him glory. And so in that vein, I'm going to ascribe to him glory right now by sharing a story over this last week. It was Monday night going into Tuesday, and I was in bed and I realized I wasn't falling asleep. My mind was calm. And I realized my mind has been calm for a really long time now, and I'm just not falling asleep. And tomorrow, I have to work until after 8 o'clock because I've got parents coming over to the school and everything. And there is literally no way I'm going to be able to hack it if I don't have any sleep. There's no way I'm going to make it. And then I realized, oh, no. You idiot, Dennis. You ask God to perfect his power in your weakness. And you know God, he's always like, you know, to Gideon, he says, "Hey, that's too many soldiers. You might think you accomplished it on your own," right? And so I'm like, oh no. oh no, he's gonna do what I asked for. So there I am, getting dragged, kicking and screaming, into the sort of experience with God that David was begging for in Psalm 27, seeing God's presence, him not hiding his face. Here I am being dragged, kicking and screaming into this incredible experience that is going to enrich my relationship with God for the rest of my life at the cost of one day of discomfort. Oh, and I mean, at that point, I was not ascribing to God the glory that's due to his name. How dare I act like a spoiled teenager, right? That I'm getting slightly inconvenienced as God is doing that. And you know what? God's power was absolutely demonstrated in my weakness. I had a coworker say to me, wow, you're really gregarious today. You know, you're having all kinds of good things to say. I'm like, oh my goodness. Anyway, the glory to his name, he did exactly what I asked for. Sometimes it can be a little uncomfortable, but, and you know what? This morning's sermon was just rubbing it in, okay? God doing things through the power of his spirit. I'm like, you're just rubbing it in now. Okay, kicking and screaming. Okay, it says the voice of Yahweh is upon the waters. The God of glory thunders. Yahweh is over many waters. And this is like a response to Psalm 28:1, where David cries out, God, answer me. Do not be silent to me. Right? Now the response of God comes. The voice of God is like thunder over the face of the waters. When he responds, and you know it. And this brings up, even though I could discuss it later when he talks about him enthroned over the waters, that this whole idea of being over the flood or being over the waters is a really rich one theologically. First of all, the mythos of everybody in that region was that all of the world used to be chaos and covered in water. And Leviathan, the forces of chaos, had to be defeated and the body of Leviathan chopped up and turned into the land. Was kind of that Middle Eastern, ancient Near Eastern mythos. And God says that in the beginning he created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was over the face of the waters. So we have this vision in the creation account also of the primordial state after creation being of water over the earth, right? And that is not it. God spoke with his voice and created everything, the heavens, the earth, the seas, and that all them is. He spoke it all into existence. Jeremiah in chapter 51 speaks about this. In retaliation to this whole idea of them and their constant worshiping of other gods. Because the transcendence of God is commonly contrasted to the not entirely transcendence of the other gods. And how they're just not in his weight class. So 51:15 through 18 in Jeremiah. It says, it is he who made the earth by his power, who established the world by his wisdom and by his understanding. He stretched out the heavens. When he gives forth his voice, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and he causes the clouds to ascend from the ends of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain, and he brings forth the wind from his storehouses. See how this weather theme just continues to always be salted into these accounts of God's theophany? The thunder, the rain, the lightning flashes, right? This is almost always in there with the talking about God's greatness. There's a primordial understanding in man that God is the ruler over the weather, right? And mankind is senseless, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his graven image, for his molten images are a lie, and there is no breath in them. And so God talks about his glory, thunders and lightnings and creation of the world over the primordial. And then we get to the flood. Have you ever thought about the flood? It's uncreation. God uncreates the world, except he puts a little group of survivors on top of it, right? It's uncreation. He restores the waters over the earth. And then the drawing back of the floodwaters is recreation, right? God has recreated the world. People are like, well, what was the land like before the flood? There's no way to know, right? Where were these early places that people had before the flood? There's no way of knowing. The landscape of the earth is no doubt very different now that God has withdrawn the waters, right? Mountains have risen up. Depths have been made more low. God has recreated the world. And this also gets this God over the flood theme also gets played out in a major way when God rescues the children of Israel. He parts the Red Sea. They come through. Seas come back and get the Egyptians. And then in a more minor sense, when God is able to split the Jordan River, and then they cross over. Now, this aversion of the Israelites to get across any body of water, even so thick as the Jordan River, always causes me to think about the Mormon belief that they built a boat and sailed across the Pacific Ocean to get to the New World. I mean, they can't even make it across the Jordan, and you're telling me they got to cross the entire Pacific? I don't know. But God's in control. He could have split the Pacific if he would have wanted to. See, that I would have bought. And then God split the Pacific, and the children of Israel crossed over. I'd be like, yeah, okay, that's par for the course. That's something God would do, or at least God could do. The voice of Yahweh is powerful. The voice of Yahweh is full of splendor. And now we start getting into this talk about, continually repeating this idea of God's voice. And I have to tell you, Friday, I had finished up everything I needed before school starts on Monday. And so I got home and I've done some research and I'm trying to let some ideas cogitate through my mind while I'm, kind of laying there, maybe dozing a little bit because I need some energy to get some more work done because it's been kind of a long week. And I'm kind of dozing a little bit and then I hear this voice. And it just immediately draws me up. Rachel had called Rosie on speakerphone over the, from Illinois, and so I hear her voice, and immediately I'm up and I'm heading out to see what's going on and everything. And I thought, wow, that was a gift, right? Because here I am thinking about all these theological implications of voice, but the fact is that when there's a voice that's dear to you, right? When it's a voice that you love, it energizes you to hear it, right? Especially if you don't think you're going to hear it for a while, right? Hearing her voice was, it was like, oh, yeah. And so, God was working that to help me understand that aspect of things. The voice of God is powerful. It's full of splendor. It is a welcome sound to the ears of those that love him, right? It fills us... But we'll get more to that later because Jesus has things to say about his sheep knowing his voice. But voices carry power. Another thing about a voice, a lot of times in scripture when it talks about hearing your voice, it doesn't mean literally hearing the sound of someone's voice. It means getting what they have to say, right? One of my favorite examples is in Exodus chapter 5. In Exodus chapter 5, Moses stands before Pharaoh. I'll start in verse 1 just for some context. It says, "And afterwards, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, 'Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness.' But Pharaoh said, 'Who is Yahweh that I should listen to his voice to let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, and also I will not let Israel go.'" And this puts the problem that Yahweh is going to solve here shortly into sharp distinction, because Pharaoh is about to find out who Yahweh is. If he had known his voice and heeded it the way he was supposed to, things might have gone a little better for Egypt. But they didn't. But that was on purpose because God was accomplishing a great many purposes for the world when he demonstrated his power over the false gods of Egypt. Voice can speak of what someone has to say. It can also mean a command. This is also important for us when we hear God's voice. An example would be in Deuteronomy chapter 28. Verses 2 and 15. We're doing the blessings for keeping the commandments and curses for not keeping the commandments. And it says, and all these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you listen to the voice of Yahweh your God. And then in 15, it says, but it will be if you do not listen to the voice of Yahweh your God to keep and do all his commandments and his statutes that I will command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. And then there are a lot of verses about what will happen to them if they do not keep the listen to the voice of Yahweh, just as there were quite a few verses about blessings that would come upon them if they do listen to the voice of Yahweh. And then it says, the voice of Yahweh breaks the cedars. Indeed, Yahweh breaks in pieces the cedars of Lebanon. The cedars of Lebanon. Have you guys ever been to the Redwoods in California? Well, the people in the ancient Near East hadn't. So for them, the cedars of Lebanon were it, right? I mean, anytime you wanted to talk about the best, the tallest trees, the most amazing trees, it was always the cedars of Lebanon. Like, even as far away as Mesopotamia, the cedars of Lebanon, the forests of Lebanon were part of the mythology. That's where the gods kept their special animals, right? They always had something special to say about that because it, you know, if you were going to build a temple for your God, those were the trees you needed to cut down because they were the best trees ever, right? Not having the amazing redwoods and sequoias like we do here in the United States, this was it. This was the final word in trees as far as these people knew. And this idea is that these cedars just get snapped by the voice of Yahweh, that he blows on them and they go over. And Isaiah also has things to say about this subject in Isaiah chapter 40. And this also deals with God's transcendence. We'll take up this passage on transcendence in verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and encompassed the heavens by the span? So all the waters on earth, this part, the entire heavens in the span from fingertip to fingertip. You guys know how big the universe is, right? No, you don't. No, none of us have any idea how big the universe is. It boggles the mind to even think about it. The more we learn about how big the universe is, the bigger this passage that talks about how great God is, you know, the more it extols his transcendence. Calculated the dust of the earth by measure and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales. Who has encompassed the spirit of Yahweh, or as his counselor has informed him? The idea here is nobody has, right? Nobody is giving God. God's not like, man, I need some advice. Can you please, you know, I need some wisdom here. Can you give me some advice? The understood answer is nobody, right? Who taught him in the path of justice and taught him knowledge and made him know the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket, and are as counted as a speck of dust on the scales. Okay, so just for anyone that doesn't know, back in the day, they didn't have like set amounts of currency and stuff. So what you would do is you would have, people would mint coins, but you know, how much was there you didn't know. So you would put it on the scales, and then you would put, like, you know, a weight on the other side of the scale to see how much silver or copper or gold it was, right? How much of that metal was there, because that's the value of that. Nobody bothers before doing the weighing to get out their dust cloth and, like, you know, dust off both sides, right? Because the dust on the scales is too insignificant to matter, right? The nations of the earth are like the scales on the balance before God. They're too insignificant to even dust off. Behold, he lifts up the coastlands like fine dust, and even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. So if you were to take all the trees of Lebanon and chop them down and make them into a sacrificial pyre, and then to catch all the animals in that woods and sacrifice them enough, sacrifice them all, that is still not enough to be befitting of God's greatness, right? Even if you were to burn down the entire forest of Lebanon, God is greater still, right? You have not yet done a sacrifice that is fitting to his level of grandeur and power. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as non-existent, utterly formless. And then again, the likeness to other gods. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare with him? For the graven image, a craftsman casts it, a goldsmith plates it with gold, silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished to make such a contribution chooses a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself a craftsman to prepare a graven image that will not be shaken. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? It is he who inhabits above the circle of the earth. Its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. It's he who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to inhabit. He reduces rulers to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth formless. Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely have their stem taken root in the earth. He merely blows on them and they wither, and the storm carries them away like stubble. We have a situation that is having to be spoken against again and again and again because people just don't get it. They keep on making substitutes for the transcendent God who makes all things, against whom all creation is insignificant. He could make more of them if he liked. And people are making pieces of wood and trying to use them as a substitute for him, taking material objects and trying to use them as a substitute for this great transcendent God whose very voice carries the thunder and the lightning, and that, you know, he's just all these images of the greatness of God as compared to what it is that we substitute for him. To whom then will you liken me, that I would be his equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created the stars, the one who leads forth their hosts by number. He calls them all by name. And you thought that the people that sell Name a Star were going to name that star after you. Because of the greatness of his vigor and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. Now, since we're here, I'm going to read something that's going to come in later. We're just going to save it up because at the very end, it talks about how God gives strength to his people. Right at the end, it says, he gives power to the weary, and to him who lacks vigor, he increases might. Though youths grow weary and tired, and choice young men stumble badly, yet those who hope in Yahweh will gain new power. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. But we'll just save that one up for the end when it says about how God gives power to his people, because that's where that comes in handy. It's the same passage, though, because, again, like I said, this stuff is all related. All of it is related. He makes Lebanon skip like a calf. And Syrian like a young wild ox. You may ask, what on earth is Syrian? It's Mount Hermon. It's Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is a big mountain, at least big for the area. It's like the Himalayas or anything, right? But it's kind of located in between Israel and Syria. It kind of is so big that it kind of forms a bit of a natural boundary. Oftentimes you'll find between different areas where people live, you'll find a barrier like that. Mount Hermon is such a barrier. It's up north of Dan, but south of Damascus. Kind of a big, powerful mountain up there. Skipping like a young wild ox, that mountain, at the voice of Yahweh. Another thing I came across is the idea, and I know this is wild and crazy and everything, is the idea that before such a God, we should be humble. And that it is God's business to humble those that think that they're all that in a bag of chips, right? And you'd think that would go without saying and everything. C.S. Lewis says that humility isn't thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. I would retort that humility is understanding who God is, or at least having a pretty good idea. Because frankly, after that, you know, your opinion of yourself will be at least closer to where it should be. And the Bible certainly talks about humility coming from understanding the greatness of God and that he's into that sort of thing. So let's pop over to Isaiah chapter 2, starting in verse 12. It says, "For Yahweh of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and high, and everyone who is lifted up, that he may be made low. And it will be against all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up." These are the cedars of Lebanon. Pretty proud of themselves there. "Against the oaks of Bashan, against the high mountains, against all the hills that are lifted up, against every lofty tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the desirable craft. The loftiness of man will be bowed down, and the men who are high will be made low, and Yahweh alone will be exalted on that day. But the idols will completely vanish, and men will go into caves of the rocks and into holes of the ground, before the dread of Yahweh and the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. In that day, men will cast away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs, before the dread of Yahweh and the splendor of his majesty, when he arises to make the earth tremble. Stop regarding man, whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed?" It's a good thing for us that we don't have idols like those dumb people in the Old Testament did. Yahweh alone will be exalted. All others humbled or destroyed. Job. I love this about Job. Job is thought to be the oldest book, authored prior even to the Pentateuch. And Job 49 is just kind of God doing God things, right? God's like, "Job, you think that you can judge with me about what's right? So why don't you, you know, judge God things? Can you do God things?" Job 49, "Hast thou an arm like God?" You know, arm means his power, right? Or can you thunder with a voice like him? "Deck yourself then in majesty and excellency, and array yourself in glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of your wrath, and behold everyone who is proud and abase him." So this is God. This is what God does. He casts abroad the rage of his wrath, beholds everyone who's proud and abases them. And, you know, obviously it's ridiculous to think that we could do any of that kind of stuff, array ourselves in glory and beauty, or have power like God. That's just ridiculous, right? And that's why it's such an effective passage, because obviously, you know, Job can't do anything even remotely like that. But it shows that that's God doing God things, which is beholding everyone who's proud and bringing them low and thundering with a great and mighty voice. The book of Joel also talks about God's thunderous voice. The thunderous voice of God is oftentimes tied together with judgment. So, got a couple of passages in Joel. First one, Joel 2. Joel is all about a plague of locusts that is a picture of the invading Chaldeans, which is a picture of the great and terrible day of the Lord and the final judgment. So it's a picture within a picture within a picture, right? And so in chapter 2, we're talking about the second picture, which is, well, okay, so it's the Chaldeans. We're talking about the Chaldeans, which the locusts are a picture of, and which are themselves a picture of the final judgment. It says, "Blow a trumpet in Zion and make a loud shout on my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of Yahweh is coming. Surely it is near, a day of darkness and thick darkness." Darkness symbolizes judgment. Anytime you see darkness, it's a symbol for judgment. That's why God put the sun out for 3 hours while he was judging Jesus. "As the day is spread over the mountain, so there is a numerous and mighty people. There has never been anything like it, nor will there be again after it, for the years from generation to generation. A fire consumes before them, and behind them flames burn. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but a desolate wilderness behind them, and nothing at all escapes them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, and like war horses, so they run. With the noises of chariots, they leap on the tops of the mountains, like the crackling of a flame of fire consuming the stubble, like a mighty people arranged for battle. Before them, the people are writhing, their faces are pale. They run like mighty men, they climb the wall like men of war, and they each march in line, and they do not deviate from their paths. They do not crowd each other, they march everyone in his path. When they fall against the defending weapons, they do not break ranks. They rush on the city, they run on the wall, they climb up into the houses, they enter through the windows like a thief. Before them the earth trembles, the heavens quake, the sun and the moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. But Yahweh gives forth his voice before his military force. Surely his camp is very numerous, for mighty is he who does his word. The day of Yahweh is indeed great and very awesome, and who can endure it?" The day of judgment, because the children of Israel are going to make a vital error. They're going to think that they can get away with being a bunch of idolaters when God said he was going to judge them for that. And so the Chaldeans are his instrument of judgment. And then in Joel chapter 3, the picture moves to the end times. It says, "Call out this message among the nations. Set yourselves apart for a war. Rouse the mighty men. Let all the men of war approach. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears." So this is the message that God is sending out. Hey, guys, come get your weapons. Make as many weapons as you can. Let everybody have a weapon in their hands. Come on, let's fight. Bring yourselves. It's not a fair fight, guys. "Let the weak say, I am a mighty man. Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Bring down, O Yahweh, your mighty ones. Let the nations be roused up and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Send in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their evil is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of Yahweh is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. And Yahweh roars from Zion, and gives forth his voice from Jerusalem. And the heavens and the earth quake, but Yahweh is a refuge for his people, and a strong defense to the sons of Israel." So all at once, the voice of Yahweh is comforting to his people because of his strength. But to those who are his enemies, the people who would decide that they're going to run their own business, who would like to trust in idols, our imaginations cannot even summon up anything as frightening. I mean, throw anything anyone's ever invented for frighteningness up against facing the awesome power of Yahweh. I mean, you can't get away. You can't fool him. You can't hide from him. There's no getting away. He's all powerful. He's all knowing. There's nothing even remotely as frightening. A voice like thunder. So the final day of judgment against men. The voice of Yahweh hews out flames of fire. Which is probably talking about lightning, right? Because the whole theme here is thunder and lightning and a huge banger of a thunderstorm, which they get in the Mediterranean. The voice of Yahweh causes the wilderness to tremble. Yahweh causes the wilderness of Kadesh to tremble, which means that this thunderstorm has gotten pretty far inland, moving into the area of Kadesh. It's under the control of Israel at this time, but it's considerably further inland than Lebanon is, where the trees were getting all, you know, torn up. And so I think that this is a good time to talk about God's voice being like thunder. And we've already talked quite a bit about his voice being like thunder, because it is literally everywhere. So Job 36. I'm going the wrong direction. I was in Joel. I need to go the other way. Okay. Remember that you should exalt his work. Of which men have sung. All men have beheld it. Men look from afar. Behold, God is exalted, and we do not know him. The number of his years is unsearchable. For he draws up the drops of water. They distill rain for his stream, which the clouds pour down. They drip upon man abundantly. Can anyone discern the spreading of the clouds, the thundering of his pavilion? Behold, he spreads his lightning about him. He covers the depths of the sea. For by these he judges people. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its thundering declares about him, the cattle also concerning what is coming up. At this also my heart trembles and leaps from its place. Listen closely to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that goes out from his mouth. Under the whole heaven he lets it loose, and his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice. He does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders with his voice marvelously, doing great things, which we do not know. For to the snow he says, fall on the earth, and to the downpour of rain, and the downpour of rains be strong. He seals the hand of every man, that all may know his work. Then the beast goes to its lair, and it dwells in its den. And out of the south comes the storm, and out of the north the cold. From the breath of God, ice is made, and the expanse of the waters is frozen. Have you ever thought that just because we can explain the processes by which thunder and lightning and frost take place, that doesn't in any way change the fact that all of these processes are all taking place by the express command of God? Every last time a raindrop falls on your windshield, it's doing so because God told it needed to do that. And here we are, living in a world that requires rain, right? It requires rain, or otherwise we all die, right? And God sets up a system by which rain is generated by these mobile units that go across the face of the earth, dropping rain, and it's powered by the huge nuclear explosion that is like roughly 8 light minutes from us, right? And all of the power necessary comes from that giant nuclear explosion, approximately 8 light minutes from us. We don't have technology even remotely that great. We're like, let's do some green technology, right? We have nothing on what God set up here, right? This automatic watering system, the lightning fixes nitrogen into the soil. The more we learn, it's not that we're like, oh, well, now we don't need God anymore. No. The more we learn, the more we're like, oh, my goodness. This is so far beyond us. When you look at the drugs that we have, they're almost all like we found something in nature and we're like, oh, and we like figured out how to make it ourselves, right? The coon snail will kill you dead. And it has like, what, like 50 compounds in it that are being studied right now as medicine? They're like making heart medicines out of one of the compounds, of which there are like 50 in coon snail venom. Aspirin comes from the bark of a tree. We're just recycling the stuff that he's done, right? And so you look, people look back and they're, oh, they think that lightning comes from God. Yeah, it all comes from God. And it's incredible. Every last bit of it is incredible. He scatters the cloud of his lightning. Whether for correction or for his world or for loving kindness, he causes it to happen. And I think sometimes we lose sight of just how majestic and beyond he is. And I think we just need to think about it more, right? Now, also along the lines of God's thunderous voice, in 1 Samuel 7 through 11, there records there that there was a battle, and Samuel was leading the troops of Israel out to do battle against the Philistines. And it's won because God thunders and the Philistines are like, ah, I'm out of here. And so they basically run for it. And then if you guys remember way back in Psalm 18, where there was that theophany we talked about in Psalm 18. Well, that's also in 2 Samuel 22. And it talks about God and his power and his rescuing of David from all of his enemies. And so that also talks about the thunder of God's voice. It says, the voice of Yahweh makes the deer to calve and strips the forest bare. And in his temple, everything says glory. So we're back to this glory, right? Again, that's that chiastic structure, right? The flood, the glory, that kind of stuff. It repeats. That's the way the poetry is meant to do. In Isaiah 6, 1 through 5, I think we're all pretty familiar with this one. It's when Isaiah has the vision of God and the glory of him is filling the temple. And the angels are flying around the place. And they got six wings. They're using two of them to fly. And two of them cover their eyes. And two of them cover their feet. And they cry out, holy, holy, holy is Yahweh, the Lord God Almighty. All the earth is full of his glory. Well, they're right, you know. Oh, I'm going to read this one. Isaiah 8. Because we love our conspiracy theories. Right? Oh, no. They're running the country. They're taking over. What happens when these guys get their way? They're going to enslave us all. Oh, no. Right? But God has a solution to conspiracy theories. Isaiah chapter 8, verse 11. You might want to write this one down. You're going to be like, wow, that solves the conspiracy theory problem. For thus says Yahweh, spoke to me with a strong hand and disciplined me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, you are not to say it is a conspiracy. In regards to all that this people call a conspiracy, and you shall not fear what they fear, and you shall not tremble. It is Yahweh of hosts whom you should regard as holy, and he shall be your fear, and he shall be your cause of trembling. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. Who's almighty? What conspiracy is going to take place that he is not going to be able to stop if it pleases him? The only thing you need to fear is Yahweh. Everything else, you just leave it to him. That's the solution to the conspiracy theory. Because can they accomplish it if he does not let them? No, they cannot. So you fear Yahweh and let him take care of everything else. Indeed, Yahweh sits enthroned over the flood. Yahweh sits as king forever. Yahweh will give strength to his people. Yahweh will bless his people with peace. Okay, remember that part about the Lord gives strength to his people. They will run and not be weary and walk and not faint. Okay, that was for that part. Okay, let's pop on over to the New Testament, because I don't want to lose some of the important stuff in the New Testament, because, quite frankly, that's where we're supposed to be getting to here, right, guys? Because understanding the transcendent majesty of the Father, the transcendent majesty of Yahweh, is key to understanding some of the things you see in the New Testament. Luke chapter 3. Verse 21. And now it happened, when all the people were being baptized, Jesus was also baptized. And while he was praying, heaven was opened, and the Holy Spirit descended upon him in bodily form like a dove, and a voice came out of heaven, "You are my beloved Son, and you I am well pleased." The voice of the Lord thunders over the people and affirms Jesus. John 12. I've gone too far. That's the Acts. Now my soul has become dismayed. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. And a voice came from heaven. I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. So the crowd of people who stood by and heard it were saying that it had thundered. Others were saying, an angel has spoken to him. And Jesus answered and said, this voice has not come for my sake, but for your sake. The voice of the Lord, the power and the witness, the voice of the Father confirming the Son and his work on this earth. Luke chapter 8. Everything that we've talked about up to this point, we come to verse 22 in Luke chapter 8, and it says, now it happened that on one of those days he and his disciples got into a boat, and he said to them, let us go over to the other side of the lake. So they set sail. But as they were sailing along, he fell asleep, and a windstorm descended on the lake, and they began to get swamped and in danger. And they came to him and woke him up, saying, Master, Master, we are perishing. And he woke and rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. Now, I hope you guys realize from what we've been talking about, that's God stuff to do. You know, we live in a world where we've got like, oh, no, you know, this superhero or that super. No, no, that's God's purview. Nobody else tells the weather what to do. The weather obeys God. And he said to them, where is your faith? They were fearful and marveled, saying to one another, who is this then that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him? In another place, it says, and then they were very afraid. They were afraid when the storm was there. And then after Jesus calmed the storm, then they were very afraid, because they realized, they got an inkling of what was in the boat with them. The one who commands the wind and the waves. The one whom even the wind and the waves obey. John 10. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd to the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. And when he brings out all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. A stranger they will never follow, but will flee from him because they do not know the voice of strangers. We have a psalm that speaks about some of the most primordial and ancient of the understandings that man have about God, his mastery of the weather, the supernatural awe that you get of God when you are involved in something like a thunderstorm, understanding that, you know, whatever our modern mind might want to make out of it, that awe is supposed to be there. God's power is ever so much greater than just that thunderstorm. And as we go through life and we follow God, we come to understand his voice. When things are happening in our life, the Spirit is leading us. We now have the ability to go into the presence of his transcendent majesty anytime we want. The ancients would fear to go anywhere near him. It could mean death. And yet a way has been purchased for us. So many things have taken place since those ancient days. The promise of a Messiah. A way has opened up between us. God has gone from being that inspires fear and you throw yourself on the ground. People still do that. Anytime they run into God and they in the scriptures, they fall straight on their faces because of his majesty. But now we can call him Father. But he is still awesome. He is still powerful. We still need to know his voice so that we can follow him. Yeah, and there's just something special and energizing about the voice of Yahweh. And so to know his voice and to know who he is and understanding the awesome, transcendent God makes it so much more special to understand about his gentleness and his love and how he leads his sheep and he cares for them, despite the fact that it takes a lot of gentleness when you're that powerful, not to just like, you know, zap us like bugs or something, right? Anyway, that's what I got, guys.